Hi, I'm John Ingold.
And I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week, we open the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book to a different page and invite the author of an article on to talk to us about the work they do as an interactive writer and the article that they wrote for the book. This week, we're very excited to have a superstar of the writing community, Anna Megill, with us today. Hi, Anna. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you for having me. Thanks for calling me a superstar. I will pay you later. I
appreciate it. We call everybody a superstar, but I'm glad it worked.
I feel better. Yeah, thanks. Taking the money back then. Yeah.
No, sorry. I'm joking. Thank you very, very much for joining us. For the benefit of listeners who might not know your name, though I almost certainly know your work, could you quickly tell us, who are you? How do you fit into the game writing community? What have you done so far with your career?
It's a good question. So I am Anna Megill. I am a game writer and proud of that. I always say that rather than a narrative person. I've been doing this for about 22 years now, wildly, mostly in AAA. I've worked on some games you might know, including Dishonored, Death of the Outsider, Guild Wars 2, Fable, the new Fable, and Control, just to name a few. I got my start in QA. I've also done some narrative editing, as well as some narrative design. And I mention that because it's going to be relevant later. Looking at games holistically, yes.
Amazing. We have some actual foreshadowing in the first question.
What could be more appropriate? It's even
set
better.
Up,
it's
set yeah, up absolutely. And layoff, yeah.
Talent exactly. At work.
Well, why don't we
fire that early Chekhov's gun here and go with your article. So your article is titled Leave Nothing on the Table. And Anna, please, if you would summarize it for us, give us a sense of what you chose to write about.
So first, I'm going to contextualize it for you. I was taking a trip through the Nordics, and about halfway through, just over the Christmas break, and I caught a really horrible cold, or a flu or something. And so I was laid up in bed with a fever, and playing a video game to pass the time. And the video game, the last hour of it, was almost entirely cinematics, broken up periodically by a little bit of a boss fight. And I'm not a fan of boss fights. And lying there in my fever state playing this game, I'm like, is this really where we are in 2026? I will mention that it was a new game and it was very well received, very popular. And I'm like, here in the year of Luigi 2026, we are still separating cinematics and gameplay and then just trying to mash them together and make them kiss somehow. And I was thinking about it, and in my, again, fever state, I decided to write about this. And so I wrote a bit of a, rant about how we as game writers and narrative designers and people who tell story have a whole tool set at our disposal. We have everything from, UI. Obviously, we have things like dialogue and text, but we also have, music. We have environmental design, and there are all of these things that we can use. And to see a game that leans so heavily on cinematics when there are all these other things it could be doing just really kind of broke my heart and made me want to talk about, I think, a better way to approach story, which is with less dialogue and fewer cinematics and a more whole experience way of living the story, because that's what games do that films don't do. And I like to lean into that. So that is the story of my rant.
Of your article and where it came from.
Yeah.
Right. So I like this. Okay. So I think it's worth, because your career has been so deep in AAA, although clearly you've worked on a variety of different projects, it strikes me that there are some unusual challenges. John is going to laugh because this is one of my favorite topics, right? So there are some unusual challenges about particularly large organizations. And I find it endlessly fascinating how a given studio has chosen to structure itself to keep a sort of golden thread in the course of producing something that is complex. And I think that complexity, you tell me if how you feel about this, but it strikes me that the bigger the company, the complexity is driven more by how many different departments or specialties have to interact to produce something. And so the types of work you're describing are harder theoretically to produce. How do you, or how have you managed to keep lots of different groups of people aligned, incorporate their opinion, and yet still output something like Threshold Kids, let's say, that is absolutely a multidisciplinary project?
It's different at every studio, obviously, because they are all set up differently. And I employ what I call guerrilla tactics, which is just anything. I go ambush people in the elevator to talk about story if that's what I have to do. But I do think that there are two things that AAA has that are advantages, which is that they do have full-time writers who are on staff, usually from the start of the project, and who are there through the duration of the project. Usually at least the lead writer and narrative director are there. So they can be not just vision holders, but they can be vision proselytizers throughout this long process, right? So they can get people on board early, understanding what the themes of the story are going to be, what kinds of things that we're doing. And they can start affecting what the gameplay is going to be, the methods for delivering the story, and help tailor those toward the kind of story that's going to be told from the very start, and help other teams understand what it is that they're trying to say, because everyone's a storyteller. I mean, everyone in every discipline is a storyteller in their own way. Sometimes they don't know it. And it's your job to go and talk to them about how the work that they're doing, that they, in their own little silo, may just be thinking of, this is a cool way to kill someone with a weapon, right? And you're just like, you know, this is an interesting thing and I could use it over here. And suddenly they start seeing the possibilities. And my goal is to get them coming to me and going, hey, I made this thing. Right. How could you use it? Is there a way that you think you could use this in your story? And I think the games I've worked on where that was most successful are games like Control, where you can sort of see the themes in the beginning and then how they resonate all the way through to every single part of the game. And really, that is the game I've worked on, I think, that has the most thematic resonance. I think Dishonored Death of the Outsider also has that quite a bit, where you can feel it in every aspect of the game and you can feel that storytelling and you pick something up and know that it is part of this greater whole and you can see how it fits into it. I think Hades is another game that does that really well, to talk about something that's not mine. Like every part of that game, even the name of the boons, like, you know, and how they work in gameplay is an extension of these characters who are an extension of the world. And it's all holistic and beautiful. I could talk about Hades for just a full half hour on its own. So try not to go down that rabbit hole, but I am a huge fan.
That's very cool, actually. No one's mentioned it on the podcast yet, so we haven't actually had that.
Surprisingly.
There's a few of them we've had, but we haven't had that one. So do you find that other members of the team are generally quite excited when you're kind of coming to them and saying, hey, actually, you know what, I can take this creation, I can build it into the narrative, I can make you part of the storytelling team? Is there generally a desire in the other departments to get stuck in and involved with the narrative process?
Maybe not. In the beginning, like sometimes there is this initial resistance of, oh, are you coming over here to tell me how to do my right. craft, right? And I think you really have to say to them, no, what I'm saying is let's work together. Like, you know, we are intertwined. And once they, if you approach them in that spirit and they see that that is your genuine belief and that you just want to tell stories with them together and you're not trying to dictate, they usually get on board and they see the possibilities, because it's flattering to have someone come in and see the potential in your discipline and really care about the work that you're doing and want to find ways for you to express yourself more in the game too. And I think it's hard to say no to that if you really care about it.
I love that.
That to me really is the...
Yeah, it's a really nuanced answer, because I often think of it in terms of this sort of, there's the gameplay and the narrative split, and people are always kind of these, the two departments that, it's not that they're at war with each other, but neither of them talk to each other, and that's how you end up with your cutscene model that you were talking about before. But kind of, there's almost a political project involved with bridging that divide and getting people to see how they can cross-communicate.
Yeah,
but it has to be sincere too, though, right? Like you can't go there and just have an agenda and try to be like, oh, I'm just going to be nice to them until I can impose my story view on them. Like you really have to be right? You have to go in there in the spirit of compromise and saying they need something too. How can we work together to make this the best experience for the player at the end of the day? You know, maybe we don't need as much story here as I think we do. Is there a more elegant way of doing this? And I think that word elegant is something that I use a lot when I'm writing and when I'm working with other teams, because I'm perfectly fine cutting dialogue. It's very expensive to make dialogue. I'm perfectly fine cutting cinematics if there's a better way to do it. And I find the longer I've been in games, and especially in AAA, it's like I'm leaning more and more toward gameplay and environmental design and lighting and all the other tools that I have to tell my story, and leaning less on dialogue and, mm-hmm. and cinematics. I mean, we do have such profoundly good cinematics in AAA now too, that like I can cut a lot of dialogue because now the actor's expressions can convey so much. Yeah. And it's really, you know, it's hard to break, I think, traditional game writers of the idea that we have to say it all, and that we can actually express things now through action and expression. But I think once they get it, it's really a whole new world opens up for them of the subtleties of our ability to tell stories now.
That's really interesting. I haven't heard anyone with kind of the length of perspective that you've had really kind of point out that shift in the writing requirements because of what we can do visually now. But I think that's absolutely true. And you see that kind of in early film as well, where kind of early movie stars are really explaining everything because you can't show anything on screen. Everything is happening off camera. Yeah. Whereas these days, we've almost gone too far the other way in film, I feel like, where we have to see everything and no one ever talks about anything. But that's another conversation.
Well, but it's interesting, actually, the film example is interesting because at that period of time, you see actors who had to live through the transition. And that's really interesting, where the people who are living through like the advent of the talkies or through mm-hmm. the shift in certain film techniques, and how you would see some certain films that are over-explained in the period where they don't need to be. And we're very much kind of in that window for the right type of project. I agree with all of this. I think that I'm really curious about the actual crunchy details of it, because I think what you just said is exactly right, that like mm-hmm. you have to go to another department in a spirit of compromise. But of course, you don't go in a total vacuum. It's so funny, right? It's like if you were in a theater project, the notion that you would go to the costume designer and they would not be interested in the story feels absurd, right? Like they'd be like, well, of course it's mine. It's as much mine as it is yours. I just have a section of it, right? Yeah. Whereas like sometimes I think because there has been a history of narrative being external, and then having been brought internal, perhaps over the last 15 years or so, we have over-pushed our boundaries on occasion, or people have felt like squashed a little bit. So it's like you have to work from, I guess the crunchy bit I'm curious about is you have to talk to them surely with some shared notion of what you're making to begin with, right? Like, is that, and you have to have authority, right? So the monkey politics of it can't be ignored, right? If you're the junior writer coming in, it might not be the most appropriate conversation. So do you usually find yourself making like a shared Miro board or like a lore document? Like how do you manage to do this across the different departments so you have a productive chat when you go there?
So to get into the sort of crunchy politics of it, you do have to create an atmosphere on the project where you have a senior designer who will listen to that junior writer, because I think the juniors are coming in with some of the best ideas. They're the ones who are playing these new games, who are seeing the cutting edge stuff, and who are willing to question things that I think, you know, we dinosaurs have just been doing for so long that you just stop thinking about it in a way. Like, well, of course that's how you make this. Of course that's how you write this. And I think having new people, you know, these kids, I'll just say it, these kids coming in, they have all these new ideas. They've been playing the latest games. And they're, you know, they're questioning things that we dinosaurs have been doing forever. And they're right to, you know, it makes you stop and take a look at them and say, you know, why are we doing it this way? Does it have to be done this way? And you can re-examine it. I worked on a game called Guild Wars 2, where they questioned all of the MMO conventions. Why does it have to be this way? Why do you have to stand in one place? Why do you have to have this makeup of your guild in order to succeed at all of these missions? And I'm not saying that they completely went back and redesigned everything, but what they included was very thoughtful, and they came up with a sort of new way of looking at it. And I think this, you know, these fresh eyes coming in can do the same thing for us in the studio, and I've completely forgotten the question that I was supposed to be answering.
No, that was it, which was how do you go about going to other people? But this is a key part of it.
There was more, it was a two-parter.
Law documents and shared visions and things like that.
Story Bible, which I think we're leaning toward calling story guides now, so as not to be like religion specific. But in the beginning, I've written quite a few of these. It is going around and talking to every team, you know, and sort of having an idea of the game that you want to make, even if you don't know what the story is that you're trying to tell yet. And finding out how everyone is interpreting the themes that they have and finding out, you know, what they are going to bring to that. And then my job as the writer is to sort of synthesize all of these different ideas from people. Put them all into one document that becomes sort of our source of truth. And then everyone can look at that and see this big picture, right? And see all of the different things that other people are contributing. And, you know, and you create this wonderful, perfect vision of the game, then you almost immediately abandon it, right? And
start making
the game. I always say it's a living document and it should update as you move along. But obviously, eventually the game becomes your source of truth. And that's what you turn to. But it's really useful to have at least this like point in time where you did all share this vision and you can refer back to that and be like, oh, yes, that's right. That's what we're trying to make here. And this is what they were saying. Whatever did happen to your idea for this? Why did that get cut? Is there a way we can include that in? And making sure that everyone's on the same page. And that's really how you get these games that feel like they're all of one piece.
So, and presumably that also helps to bring everybody into a real sense of shared ownership on the kind of narrative and the vision side of the project really early on, so that when you're going to talk to these people later, that it's not a completely left field idea to be thinking in these narrative terms. I think that's,
Exactly. I mean, it is, it's about that respect for their craft. And I've learned a lot. Like, I think I truly approach other disciplines with humility, because I'm maybe good at what I do, but I have no idea sometimes what they do. And it's always sort of surprising and eye-opening to see that many people do actually approach their craft with this idea of storytelling. Like, I'm telling the story of this game through, you know, through these weapons. Like, you can track the whole history of the world through these various weapons that I have, and they all have personality and character that, you know, express what these characters are doing. And it's like, wow, you know, I didn't know that, or I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't talked to you. So.
I remember during the development of Heaven's Vault, we had a lead artist who was really, I want to say obsessed, but that's pejorative. She was just really detail focused on the construction of the way that walls were built. So every time there was a wall, she'd want to know what the surface on the inside and then what was on top of that, what was on. And I was a bit sort of like, I don't really care. But after a while, I kind of came to respect it, because it meant that we actually had to think about how materials moved across the history. And suddenly we had this architectural history of the nebula, and people would go, oh, this site is older than this site because you can see the way that window technology has evolved. And I'd be like, right, I'm taking no credit for this, but it's an amazing thing to have kind of lucked into as a process, I think. Again, that thing of finding respect for other people's craft that you just didn't even realize they were doing it at the time.
And think of what you now don't have to explain to players, that it's just there, visible in these walls. So you don't have to do a lore dump somewhere about the history of it. It's all just right there. I think people can get really caught up, especially writers, because lore is so fun, right? You're Tolkien. Yeah. You're creating this whole history of your world and all the languages and people in it. And I think they get so bogged down in that it can weigh down the story sometimes and weigh down the world. I mean, there's a very specific kind of player who loves that stuff and who is going to read it and eventually know it better than you do, which has happened to me a few times. But for the most part, your story needs to not be weighed down by that and just be agile and move through this world that has taken the load of all of that off you, so you can just experience as much or as little of it as you want.
So that really neatly leads me on to actually one of the things I wanted to ask you about with this, which is thinking of it as a discussion of practical world building, how we actually go about doing world building. Do you find for your process, for the process that you prefer, because people mm-hmm. are different, but obviously filtered through what you're allowed to do, given the context that you're working yeah. in. Do you find that you start off building very complicated worlds and then figuring out how to stream that information to the player? Do you build as little world building as possible and then just see what emerges from the kind of activities that the player gets up to? Like, I guess in the context of this article, I was really thinking, do you build the world and then start looking for opportunities to seed it? Or do you literally go to people and say, oh, those are cool swords. Let's make curvy swords a thing that somebody in this world does because we have it in the bag of things and we might as well explain it. Like, are you a fixer of world building? Do you have these big ideas or is it much more fluid than that? How do you think you kind of get from nothing to something holistic? Like, what kind of process does that take for you?
You're going to hate this answer because it's the same for everything. It depends on the project because, you know, with games like Control, where you have a brand new world that didn't exist before, we had to figure out how things worked in order to figure out how to tell our story, in order for people to figure out how to even make this game or think about it. So we have these big story summits, which, because it was Finland, took place in a sauna. Very, very cool. And we would come into it with questions going, you know, how does this thing in our world work? What is happening when the house shifts? If you're at a threshold, is there a middle point or is it just inside and outside? Or is there a liminal space where you're somewhere in between? Like, these are all things that we had to figure out. These are just sort of basic laws of the universe. And that stuff, I think, needs to be locked down in the beginning. And, you know, it doesn't have to be super detailed, but there has to be enough of it to give the world a shape and to give people a place to stand on so that they can practice their craft and do the rest. And then once you have that in place and everyone's standing firmly on ground and they know, okay, this is a location or this is the world and this is how it basically works, then you start doing it on a case-by-case basis. And maybe someone will, on their own, come up with those curvy swords, and you see them, and you're like, oh, I can incorporate that here, no problem. And it does become sort of a back and forth at that point of different people contributing, you seeing things and sort of adopting them. Or I won't name the project, but on one project that had multiple studios, there was a studio that had created all of these like absolutely massive locations without the story team being aware of it. And so one day someone basically said, where do you want all these giant forts? And I'm like, what? These what? And I looked at them and we then had to figure out how to incorporate these absolutely huge locations that were frankly a little bit lore breaking into our story. And so that required rejiggering an entire part of it. And that's when things go bad, right? That's when communication has broken down and it's not good. But the work has been done, and at that point, you have to figure out how to make it work, and how to make it not break your lore, and how to make it make sense for the story you're telling.
And you're kind of flipping into problem solving mode rather than kind of fully creative mode.
Exactly. Yeah. You're spackling over something rather than making it feel holistic. And I think people can usually tell, like when that happens, when something feels a little off, and you're not quite sure why. When that happens.
Mm. I love the idea of a sauna-based meeting. It's like the old pizza rule from Facebook, you know, which sort of limits the number of people in the room because they all have to be able to eat one pizza. Oh. But instead it limits the amount of time any meeting can possibly take, because presumably after about 20 minutes, people start dropping out and fainting. So like you have to get them out of there.
It wasn't in the actual hot part of the sauna, although that was there. It was in the like...
You ruined my image.
Yeah, sorry. It was in that... Finland, you know, there's a sauna on the top floor of the studio in Remedy. If you ever go there, they have a sauna there. But that's not where the meetings take place because, yes, it's hard to concentrate after a while. You just want to sweat. So we had a meeting room outside with a nice little fireplace and snacks, and it was really lovely, conducive to talk.
Yeah, it sounds extremely civilized to me, frankly.
Yes. Very clean and healthy, I will say that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a good way to do it.
You know, so I'd like to turn to a section of your article. So you say something that I agree with. My old boss used to say, I'm in violent agreement with this when he was very excited about something. So I'm in violent agreement with the statement that that you are fascinated by sub-narratives and meta-narratives. Like, I love those. Yeah. They are clearly more than just Easter eggs and secrets. They are extended narratives, right, that can be found and that sort of convey what might be happening in the background or with other characters, let's say. But they are typically optional parts of the game. You wouldn't mm-hmm. perhaps expect every player to find them. They are a sort of delight if a player does find them. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I find that they look like juicy slabs of meat for the producers to chop up and slice away for scope reasons, right? So how do you possibly keep them in, right? How do you keep those flourish moments still in your projects?
I think it depends on, I'm sorry, it's going to be this answer for everything. I think it depends on what you're trying to do with them and what the project is. Like sometimes you can have, I'm thinking of something like Stanley Parable, right? Where it seems to be a game about one thing. And actually there's this whole meta narrative that makes it all about something completely different, right? And it becomes about free will and what are you doing? And that's the game. And that's obviously not going to get cut, right? You know, or something like...
Right. It's core to it. Yeah.
That's what the whole game is about. Or something like in Hades, where you have that moment. This is the stripped down version, where the clue that sets Zagreus off on this hunt to find his mother is the fact that the narrator slips up and says something. And that's what starts this whole quest. I mean, that's sort of a meta reference. Thing that gets you going. It can be as simple as that, right? You know, just this one juicy little thing that most players I think will probably miss and not get, and you know, as big or small as you need it to be.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Like to use a hook where you can use a meta narrative or sub narrative, but it's tied or locked into something that's critical to the story. So less likely to get cut than say a secondary meaning inside of the hidden inside of your item descriptions or something like that, right? That,
well, like my threshold kids, I feel like you're giving me a softball to talk about them, so I'm gonna take it.
please do.
But I mean, it fills in the whole backstory that you don't get to witness at the oldest house. This is the education of these kids who are in the program to become directors. And their training there and what that looks like and how, frankly, abusive it is. And it's told, you know, as this little side narrative or sub-narrative. You can skip it. You can not watch these videos. I've watched people just shoot out the TV screens rather than have to watch another one of those cursed videos.
I didn't know you could shoot them. I watched every single one very diligently. I didn't even know it was possible to shoot them. Wow.
Yeah, how brutal. People certainly try. As they hear the theme song come on, they're like, no, shaking hand. you're right that they are easily cuttable, right? Like you could have cut that and it wouldn't have made any difference to the game. It's just this little sort of rabbit hole you can go down and come out on the other side. It gives extra information, but it's not critical to the game. But for the people who do care about it and who do invest in it, it's doing a lot of heavy lifting for just these few short little bits in the game. And I think that's why it's important. And that got made again because I just wouldn't give up on the idea, but also because people on other teams got passionate about it. They bought into the idea for this. And like even the little outfits that the puppets wear, like the costume designer got really into the challenge of making those and was designing them for their personalities and to further deepen the story, right? So, I think that's always the key, yeah.
So I kind of get the sense that there's a bunch of different factors at work there. There's mm-hmm. how much value is this thing giving the kind of the people who engage with it, but also how much is it literally costing to make, but also something else about like how much are you letting other departments flourish? I like this word flourish for it. Like how much are you letting the other departments have a flourish moment as well? Because like obviously as writers, we love to like put in something quirky and cool and we're really proud of, but actually the costume department want to have a chance to do that. And the weapon designers want to have a chance to do that. The combat designers want to have a chance to do that. So it's kind of trying to find moments that bring everyone together for, like it's like a fun day out almost in the creative process or something.
Yeah, I mean, my rule for that is if you can get someone excited about it who's not on your team, it will probably make it into the game because they will help you fight for it. And if there's more than one department fighting for that thing, then usually it has a chance.
I really like that actually because it reminds me of what you were saying about the story summits. I got distracted by the topic of saunas because I have a link to Finland in my family. But the more interesting thing that you said there was actually about having a story summit at the beginning, because I suppose one of the other things that does is it proves to you like it proves that the basic concepts of the world, whatever they are, I think you said the kind of the fundamental rules of the world,
yeah,
are things you can explain to people and they can walk away with them and understand them and have them. And everyone in the art team or the audio design team gets the world, because if they do, then the player will as well. Whereas if you come up with something horrifically complicated and detailed and intricate in a sort of, I don't know, I want to pick on JRPGs for this, so I don't know if that's fair completely, but something really complicated, then you can't explain it to someone in a sauna meeting and you can't like get everyone on board with it, because everyone's always going to be like, hang on, how many factions are there and what are they doing? And like,
yeah,
so it's got this sort of baseline. If you can sell it within your team, you can probably sell it outside of your team as well. Mm-hmm. That's not a question, but it's an interesting, I like those way those two things fit together. Over to Saga for an actual question.
Actually, I'm curious whether what John is saying is right. Is that right? Or is it possible for you to, particularly at the start of the project, like, I don't know, Anna, if you're often brought in at the time at which a lot of these world building challenges are still open and are given to you as, can you please help us find a way of making this coherent? Almost always, surely, there is some notion of like, we're telling this type of thing, we are going to have this type of game, we don't yet know the characters of the world or something, right? Mm-hmm. Is there a danger of being too persuasive in the short term? In other words, in those key moments where you are like pitching your story, because you want to pitch it in its best light and see if it lands, right? But could you accidentally, inadvertently pull the wool over everyone's eyes and like convince them for a little while of the merits of what might be a very flawed story later? How, like, what checks could one put in place to really check if you have a good idea or a bit of a dud?
Time, honestly. I think you don't know if it's a good idea or not sometimes until you're a little ways down the road, because especially in the beginning when you're in blue sky, right? It's like
completely all
ideas should be considered. You know, no one should be locking themselves down. You should be open to these possibilities. That's what that time is for. And yeah, it is entirely possible that I have this idea in my head about what the story should be. And then as things start to crystallize and we start getting a sense of what this game is going to be, we realize, oh, that contradicts basically what we're trying to do in this right. world. This is what we're trying to say. Or I don't know if that's enough story to fill an 80-hour game in this world. And, you know,
I
have never written a story for a game that where the first version is what made it to the end. So, of course, your story is constantly adjusting as you go along. I mean, 13, 14 versions of like the short pitch, not unusual at all, as you're adjusting it. And you just have to learn to keep it brief and iterate. And, you know, experience comes into it a lot too. Like I am at a point now in my career where I've done this enough where you just have this gut feeling if something's good or right or not, you know, and it's not something you can teach people. It's just, you know, like, oh, okay, the story seems great, but I'm hearing what other people say, and this is a direction I want to take it in and where I see this story leading. And I'm pretty sure that doesn't align with what everyone is thinking and they're telling me that they want sort of thematically. So what if I adjust it like this? Can I trim this bit off and fit it more into what they want? And then everyone sort of moves a little bit in one direction together. And that's AAA, okay. Right?
Yeah, it's like trying to run like a seven-legged race or something with every single department you're doing it. What I like so much about what you've said is this is a fundamentally optimistic vision of this, right? Like you're saying this is a learnable, perfectible skill that yes, perhaps it's a little hard in each moment to know exactly what's quite right, but you will recognize some patterns, or you'll perhaps recognize that like the world is okay, but my protagonist isn't quite exciting enough. I just worry about this moment where you are with a new team. They everyone wants to be friends with each other. They are too positive on something, and so you're sort of like, well, okay, we'll just move forward with this. But if it is a learnable skill, then over time you'll start to detect it's not yet ready for prime time or even for pitching inside of the company, and that feels cool to me. Actually, that feels really nice.
Even if you are new, though, I mean, as people start to work together and get more familiar, if it's not working, people will say so eventually, right? And like they will feel it and they will feel constricted, and you will find yourself having to defend it more and more and more. Yes. And at that point, you need to have the humility, you know, to stop and say, okay, maybe this isn't working. If I'm constantly having to defend it and people are struggling with it, what can I do to adapt it and make the story work for people? You know, without completely abandoning your vision, because that's part of it too, because you get to have a say, you know, you have as much stake in the game as anybody else does. But I think that's why when you see seasoned teams who have worked together for a while, like I don't think, you know, I probably shouldn't use the Witcher 3 example, but I had nothing to do with it. I'm not working on that game, so I'll give this. I don't think the team that created the Witcher 3 could have done that right away, right? Like, I think that mm-hmm. game is really mm-hmm. well done. It's they understood what they had. That team knew what they were working on. And they knew from experience from the first couple of games exactly how to create it. And they created a masterpiece. And again, I had nothing to do with any of those things. So I feel I can talk about it. And I still don't. I have nothing to do with any of it.
So. Yeah. I love that that idea as well of the, because we've talked a lot about world building, but I mm-hmm. guess it's just this, it's the story generally as well, being slightly crafted in a crucible, like a slightly adversarial environment, that you have a story which is full of all these mm-hmm. details and characters and moments and turns and twists and whatever, but in the end each one of them does actually need to be kind of battle tested somewhat, and mm-hmm. you need to be able to defend this choice mm-hmm. about this character and this moment beyond, oh, it's cool, or like it was the first idea we thought of, or you know, or even the director of the company really thinks it's a good idea, so we have yeah. to do it. Like, tricky. And all of those yeah. things. You need to be able to fight for each moment of the story and kind of, and if it's weak, replace it, trade it up, move it forward, make it better. So I kind of get mm-hmm. this, I love this image of a seven-legged race. Sorry, Anna, I know that wasn't your line, but I just think it's a brilliant line of like the story kind of limping and struggling. And you want to go fast, but you don't want to go too fast, because if you do, then you'll kind of you'll pull everything out of balance. Like, I can really get my head around that as a way of actually getting from the early blank slate to, you know, the enormously complicated and intricate projects that result from 100, 300 people working at the top of their game for 4 years. Like, because sometimes that gap can just seem extraordinary from the outside, and it's kind of amazing to consider how that process really works. I wanted, we've been talking for a long time about world building. I wanted to move to one other topic which kind of came up to me when I was reading your article, which is a bit perhaps I want to see what you think about it basically. So we've been talking a lot about world building and kind of backstory and the history of the world, but when we were talking at the start about cinematics, the reason games use cinematics is because stuff needs to happen right in the world. We need events to happen. So how can we start to pull away from cinematics when we need things to actually happen now, rather than happen in the past or be part of the world building, but actually happen to the player now? Is that as wide open a palette? Have we got as many different ways we can take that around the departments? Is it more complicated and more intricate, or are we missing some obvious things we could be doing there? Because obviously a cinematic, you say, well, look, I'm asserting this is what's happening now. Nobody gets a vote. This is happening. Like, mm-hmm. how do we move forward from that particular model of kind of the beats of the story? How have you seen that done well? Have you found kind of opportunities for that have worked well for you?
So there's a lot that you're saying in there. I want to sort of break it down into its component parts. Sure. So cinematics for me are when you have to tell something in a linear way, or when there's no other way to tell that, right? Like, you really do need to see very good performance capture, and you do want to have an emotional moment, and you want to make sure the player can't miss it. I mean, obviously they can skip cinematics, but for the players who are interested, they are held in this place and they are getting a curated experience, and that's what that is for. But we sort of have a golden rule in AAA, which is you have to have a damn good reason to take control away from the player. Right? You always want them, because games are about the player doing stuff. It's the player making choices and interacting with the world and navigating. And even if you're just having them walk along while they're doing something and having a talk with another character, that right there to me is more like a lived experience than just sitting there watching something unfold that you're not really part of. You may be emotionally invested in it. Obviously, films are moving. They've been moving us for decades and decades. But it's different when you're making that choice. It's different when you are choosing which road to go down, and then that has consequences for you. And maybe there's a payoff for that later. And you're like, oh no, but I made the choice to go down that road. And this happened directly because of me. And those are the moments that you want to create for players. The example I always bring up, and I mentioned it in my essay, is Brothers, because that is the holy grail for me of what games can do that no other media can do. This is going to be a massive spoiler for everyone listening to this. If you haven't played
this whole podcast is a spoiler. Yeah.
I'm going to ruin it for you. But the scene where your brother dies, where you're going down through the tree, you've just retrieved the potion and you're leaving and your brother dies. I replayed that like 5 times thinking there's got to be another way. I've done something wrong. There's got to be a way for him to not die. And I kept reloading farther and farther back going, okay, I've missed the turnoff for saving my brother. When I finally understood that there was no way for me to avoid that this is what the game said was going to happen. And this was the way it was going to play out. Like, it was devastating, like just absolutely devastating. And for those of you who haven't played Brothers, you are playing one brother on one thumbstick and the mm-hmm. other brother on the other one. And so when your brother dies, suddenly you're left not knowing how to move the controller anymore. And so you feel this physical loss. You are actually having to learn how to move the controllers again. And the awkwardness of it and the unfamiliarity of it and the shock of this new thing happening that you have to adjust to is exactly what's going on in the game with your brother's loss. And the very first thing you have to do as you're trying to figure out how to use these controls is bury your brother. And it's just this incredible moment where like emotion and physicality and gameplay all come together to tell this moment in the story in a way that no other game has, I think, quite successfully pulled off. And I'm always trying to find that. I mean, again, that was the point of that game. Like it all led up to that moment, and you know, it was crafted around it, and that was it. And I don't know how to quite get that in games, but I'm always looking, and I always want that marriage of every level of your experience tying into the story so that you can feel it. The way I still think about that gut feeling I got when it happened of just the wrongness of it. And I'm searching for that. And I can't remember what the question was, but that is my holy grail. Yeah.
It's a great answer. I love that physicality, particularly. One of my favorite games is Ico, where you have that button that you hold down to hold the little girl's hand. And there's a couple of times where you have to leave her alone and go off to another screen to go and do something. And just that, yeah, exactly. That period of not holding that button just keeps you reminding on quite an animal level, I've left this person behind. And it's so effective. And we often don't think about the physical shape of what the player is actually doing as they're playing the game.
Surely it's because loss feels so much more hard to us than gain, right? Like if you were playing the inverse of that game, or a game like this, where you gained a new ability and it like filled in something new. Well, we actually play that game all the time, right? Like that is what so many games are like. You gain a new ability, now your trigger does something that it didn't do before, and
you're holding 10 buttons down simultaneously and going, oh,
and you don't even think about it. You don't even think about it being the key thing, right? Yeah. But if you were to lose it, you do. And that's so powerful. Like that's the thing to... Perhaps that's a thing to look at using or trying to manipulate where appropriate, right, for the story, where it fits, and only sparingly, I think, because you can lose its power fast. But yeah, they're such good.
Have either of you played Rhythm Doctor? It's a game that came out last year. I haven't played it myself, but I just saw Jacob Geller did a review of it, of like games that have final levels that are just wild. And it's just a little rhythm game where you have to press the button in time. I would just encourage people to look up Jacob Geller's review of it. But they're doing things with the window of the game, like shrinking down the game to a window and then moving that around in ways that just absolutely transform the experience of the game. And you do not expect it. And it's completely wild, yet totally appropriate for this game. And it just takes it to a whole new level. And I think it's the first time I've seen something since Brothers where they really thought, outside the box. And it did something. No, yeah. I mean, go and take a look at, but it's that going, we are not confined to what is here on the screen. We're going to take this game out to your desktop. and we're going to play on your desktop, and we're going to move in between windows, and we're going to move it around your view, and we're going to force you to interact with this game in a way that completely fits in with the story that we're telling here, but that you never would have thought would be possible for a little rhythm game like this. So I just encourage you all to go check that out. It's extraordinary.
Amazing. That sounds really powerful. Definitely. It sounds like just the, like the feeling you get from Undertale or Baba Is You or something, yeah, yeah. But where it's like, yeah, everything's been a bit broken and we're back to that, like the meta narrative a little bit of what's exactly going on, playing with like the form a little bit.
I love that stuff so much. I had all of these examples I wanted to give about it. Like, I think Kentucky Route Zero is a game that plays with that a lot. Like, they had this intermission thing where you could pick up an actual phone and call a number, and it was like you were calling this agency and you would get these answers. My favorite option on that was, if you're holding a snake now, please press 4. It was just so whimsical and perfectly Kentucky Route Zero. But they did a lot with the way form and content played off each other there. And I think even the chapter 5 or act 5 in that, where you're sort of walking the loop, and it is the loop of the story and the loop of time and the loop of your experience. And it is just simply walking in a loop as a story unfolds that then leads to a funeral. But it is just a perfect encapsulation of the story that you've been through, and it contextualizes the whole thing in a way that without that, it would not have made as much sense. And I think it's that I'm looking for as well, those moments that make you rethink the entire experience you just had and view it in a different light. So those are the things I love.
Amazing.
Thank you. Thank you, Anna. Yeah. So maybe that's a good spot for us to end here. So Anna McGill, thank you so much for joining us here on today's podcast. This has been a delightful conversation with you. I hope we can have many more, in the days to come. But genuinely, a great topic for you to come to. Thank you for sharing your experience with this. We will pause there. Listeners, please join us next week. We'll be opening up the book yet again, speaking to a luminary from the game nerd of Kaleidoscope and seeing what they have to say about the craft of game writing. Thanks very much, and goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye.